guided by the principle of as I please. Listen adventurously. I am your host, Brian Johnson, and this is WORT-FM.
Hello, I'm Eileen McHugh with the BBC News. Pope Francis has died early this morning at the age of 88. He was the first Latin American pope. The Vatican said his entire life had been dedicated to the service of the Lord and his church. Born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Argentina in 1936, the son of Italian immigrants, he became a Jesuit, rising to become the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. Davide Giglioni reports.
The announcement has left the Vatican and the world in shock. The death of Pope Francis, the Catholic Church's first pontiff from the global south, occurred on Monday morning. As people flock to St. Peter's Square to pay their respects, leaders from around the world are also sending their condolences. Francis, who had been in hospital for 5 weeks due to double pneumonia, returned to the Vatican a month ago, where he had been making surprise appearances and attending Easter ceremonies.
Pope Francis had chosen not to be buried in the Vatican, like most of his predecessors, but in the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, in an area of Rome which many immigrants have made their home. He also rejected the tradition of having three coffins nestled inside each other, choosing instead to be buried in a simple casket made of wood and zinc. Rupert Wingfield Hayes has more details.
The Vatican has announced that the Pope will be placed in his coffin at 8 o'clock tonight, local time. They are holding a meeting later today to decide the exact schedule of all the ceremonies that will then take place. But we do know from past precedent that the Pope will lie in state in St. Peter's Basilica behind me for at least 3 days, and people will be permitted to process past his coffin. We expect tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people to turn out here to do so.
At the time of his election, Pope Francis was regarded as being on the liberal wing of the church. He softened the Vatican's language on issues like divorce and same-sex marriage, and reached out to leaders of other faiths, but he did not try to change the church's traditionalist teachings. Speaking to the BBC outside the Vatican, these students praised him as a very progressive pope who attempted to reach out to the younger generation.
It's a really hard job to reach younger people and younger generations, but I think he achieved as much as he can. He did put into a lot of effort into communicating with the younger generations.
He was a very progressive pope. I'm not very Catholic, but all my family is Catholic, but I was following from far. So come here to show some respect for this pope who started, let's say, a trend in the church of a more progressive one.
Spain, a devoutly Catholic country, has declared 3 days of mourning. The US President Donald Trump has posted on social media, "Rest in peace, and may God bless him and all those who loved him." You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicycleCTR.com.
Good morning, it's 8:06 and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. The battle between the federal court system and the Trump administration continues to heat up. Where will it all end? Political scientist Howard Schwaber joins us once more to bring us up to speed. And speaking of the Supreme Court, is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas a black nationalist? That's not such a far-fetched idea, and we ignore Thomas at our own peril. So says Brooklyn College professor Corey Robin, who joins us with an explanation. And on-campus chapters of World Beyond War get active this week with a panel discussion with Congressman Mark Pocan and a film screening about recent campus pro-Palestine protests. We'll hear from World Beyond War's Janet Parker. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, John Wilson. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:08. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. The stare down between the U.S. federal court system and the Trump administration intensified this past week. Trump met with Nayib Bukele, president of El Salvador, in the Oval Office. After the meeting, the two presidents threw up their hands with regard to returning wrongfully deported Kilmar Abrego Garcia. They said there was nothing either could do. This appeared to clearly defy an order from the U.S. Supreme Court, who took the unusual step of rushing a second order over the weekend to direct the president, on a 7-2 vote, to immediately cease any further deportations under the Alien Act. Federal judges throughout the U.S. court system stepped up their criticism of the U.S. Department of Justice's repeated failures to comply with court orders. If we're not in a constitutional crisis, we soon will be, as the Trump administration shows the most callous disregard for the courts since the days of Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn. With all the turmoil, we thought we'd check in once again with Howard Schwaber, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Wisconsin. I caught up with Schwaber over the weekend. Howard, since the last time we spoke, there's been a lot of developments in the Abrego Garcia case. First off, as you mentioned, President Trump had met with El Salvadoran President Bukele. At that meeting, Bukele issued the rather astonishing statement that he doesn't have the power to return Abrego Garcia. What do you make of this?
Well, this is just posturing. I mean, both Trump and Bukele were each saying, oh, I don't have the power to do anything. The whole point was that it was absurd. That is, it was a performance designed to tell everyone, see, we don't care what you say, we're not going to do anything. No one, I literally think no one who observed that press conference believed for a second that either Trump or Bukele could not arrange for the return of a prisoner if they wanted to. So that was purely a performance to say, we don't want to and we're not going to.
Now, perhaps the most important audience in all this as to whether or not they believe any of that is the U.S. Supreme Court itself. Right. We know that the Court of Appeals recently denied a request by the administration to overturn the previous order. Is this headed back to the Supreme Court?
It's already been there. Yesterday afternoon, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a truly remarkable order. So a little explanation is needed. The order simply said, for now, the government may not deport any more people under the Enemy Aliens Act, which was the 18th century law that enacted by the John Adams administration that the Trump administration has been relying on. People who took AP government in high school might remember the Alien and Sedition Acts. This is the Alien Act, half of that, which until now, usually we didn't study in high school because no one ever thought it was relevant to anything ever since about, well, the election of 1800, honestly. Leaving that aside, what made this order extraordinary was that the Fifth Circuit was considering the very question and had not yet ruled. The order was issued so quickly that Justice Alito, who intended to dissent, didn't have time to write his dissent. This is contrary to the norms of the court. Ordinarily, if one justice says, or multiple justices, you know, I want to write a dissent, they'll wait to issue the order or the opinion, whatever it is, until there's a chance to write that dissent. The majority, this was a 7-2 decision, acted with speed I have never seen before from the U.S. Supreme Court in any context. And the very unsubtle message is they don't trust the Trump administration. So on Friday, Drew Enson, a lawyer for the Justice Department, had said, we have no immediate plans to fly anybody out under this act, but we could at any time. And I think it was in response to that statement that the Supreme Court moved as quickly as it did. So something very dramatic is happening. Now, exactly what it is a good question. Clearly, the Supreme Court wanted to freeze the status quo in order to be able to deal with the underlying issues. That certainly suggests that they're not entirely friendly to the Trump administration. Up until now, precisely the move has been to delay, 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 which has allowed the Trump administration to do whatever it wanted. So in that sense, this is a sharp departure. But, you know, we shouldn't over-predict what the substantive outcome will be. The Trump administration has already, in a public statement at least, raised the point that just because the Supreme Court says that they may not deport people to El Salvadoran prison under this particular law doesn't mean they can't do the same thing under the authority of some other law if they can come up with a good candidate. It really is the case. And, you know, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now. At a certain point, there's going to be an outright showdown between the White House and the Supreme Court. We're getting really close to that. And by really close, I'm thinking tomorrow or the next day, certainly this week. The Supreme Court is going to have to decide, or the majority is going to have to decide, you know, do we stand up and say, you may not do whatever it is that we're concerned about until we've ruled on its constitutionality and legality? Or are they going to continue to allow themselves to be, frankly, played for chumps, as they have been so far?
Turning back to Abrego Garcia in particular, the court's original ruling had this word facilitate in it. And right. We've been in the semantic argument about whether a facilitate means do anything or just right. Not stand in the way. With the court's more recent order, is anything more clear?
So the first rule of litigation always is thou shalt not piss off the judge. The Supreme Court ordered the U.S. government to facilitate the return of the prisoner. The U.S. government's position was, well, that only means we have to make an airplane available if the government of El Salvador asks us to. I think part of the story is that the Supreme Court, regardless, again, of how it will ultimately rule in the merits, is simply angry. They have pissed off the judge. And, you know, if you piss off the Supreme Court, you're likely to have a showdown, and that's where we're coming. I mean, there have been several developments that are extraordinary and horrifying. Donald Trump went on television with a photoshopped picture purporting to show gang tattoos on a man's knuckles that weren't real. I don't know if the Supreme Court knows about that or noticed it. They're not the most web-savvy people necessarily, you know, but it is clear. And the lower courts have been basically screaming. The lower court judges have, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, screaming to the U.S. Supreme Court, for God's sake, step in and do something. Everything we say is being completely defied, and this administration is not acting in good faith. And as of yesterday, it looks like the Supreme Court may finally be listening. And I should point out that, again, aside from the legal and constitutional issues of the case, one of the things that Supreme Court justices care about is that the federal court system in general is treated with respect and autonomy. And the Trump administration, you know, as some of us have been saying for weeks, look, they are completely ignoring federal law. As I read it, the lower federal courts have finally gotten the U.S. Supreme Court's attention.
What are the next things to look for in this case?
I expect a very, very quick briefing schedule, an oral argument soon, and a ruling quickly on the question of whether the Enemy Aliens Act can be used at a time when there's no declared war against non-government actors, right? All the series of questions that arise. But I think it's important to step back and recognize that this is one of multiple areas where the Supreme Court, and I'll use the word again, finally seems ready to say something, because another big one is something called the Major Questions Doctrine. That doesn't have to do with this case, but it has to do with everything from DOGE, right, the Department of Government Efficiency, to the withholding of grants. Can an administration take those actions without explicit authorization from Congress? There's another issue about impoundment of grants. Can an administration refuse to spend money that Congress has allocated? There's another issue of what's called the unitary executive, which is how much authority, you know, can Congress create independent agencies? And up until now, the Supreme Court has just dodged on delayed and delayed and delayed all those questions. One of the consequences of violating the rule thou shalt not of the judge may be that the court may move more quickly than they otherwise might have to address those questions. We do know, I should point out, that on May 15th, they will hear arguments about the birthright citizenship issue. So what it looks like in the next 6 or 8 weeks, we're going to have just an unprecedented amount of activity at the U.S. Supreme Court, asking some of the biggest constitutional questions about separation of powers and executive power that we've ever seen. The backdrop to all this is this horrific case, of which there are many others, but this one has captured everyone's imagination and has gotten specific attention. You know, this horrific case of a clearly wrongful deportation. There's one last point that needs to be made. Justice Sotomayor made this point in the previous ruling, right, when she said, when the U.S. government's argument was, look, once someone is outside of our jurisdiction, there's nothing we can do. We have no power. Essentially the same claim that was made at the press conference. And the court rejected that. They said, no, you must facilitate return. And as we've already talked about, you know, now they're dodging that word facilitate. But Sotomayor pointed out, look, if we accept the administration's argument, it applies to anyone, citizen, criminal, non-criminal. Once they're outside U.S. jurisdiction, the claim is courts can order no remedy. So I'll give you a fantastic extrapolation. If Donald Trump sold 100,000 Americans into slavery in Saudi Arabia, according to the Trump administration, federal courts would have nothing to say about that. I think this is a really classic example of just overplaying your hand. The Roberts Court was sympathetic, is sympathetic to the Trump administration. As everyone knows, three of the justices were appointed by Trump, and they have been very favorable to Trump in rulings this year and last year. The immunity ruling is only one of many, many examples, but he may have overplayed his hand to the point where he has angered them. And at the end of the day, constitutional politics, like all other forms of politics, can come down to personal relations, and he may have soured these.
Does that have implications, do you think, in some of these other cases that you're talking about?
Well, it might. So I mean, let me pick one of these, which is getting a lot of attention, and rightly so. During the Biden administration, the Roberts Court invented out of whole cloth a new rule called the Major Questions Doctrine, which said if a federal agency is going to have authority over a major question, and they said absolutely nothing to explain what makes a major question, except maybe it involves a lot of money. That's literally as much guidance as they gave us. But if a federal agency is going to make a rule, it was the Environmental Protection Agency in that case, that addresses a major question, then Congress has to have specifically authorized the agency to answer that specific question. It has to be right? It can't just be the general delegation of authority. It has to be a specific. Secondly, again, in the context of the Biden administration, in the last couple of years, the Supreme Court has done away with what's called the Chevron deference doctrine. That is, federal judges are empowered to a far greater degree than they had been for the previous 60 years or so to second guess judgments of agencies and agency heads on the scope of their authority. Well, if you put those two things together, right, you now have a perfect vehicle for the Supreme Court, if it wants to say, no, Congress didn't specifically authorize DOGE to fire, you know, massive numbers of federal employees. And no, Congress didn't specifically authorize the Trump administration to cancel all these grants and shut down funding and so on and so on and so on. Any federal judge has been given the tools, as lower court federal judges already have been doing, to say, no, you may not do this. And that extends to the firings and the funding freezes and everything else. The Supreme Court is going to, in the next few weeks, and this one I don't think will be quite as quick, but in the next, you know, few weeks or a month and a half, have to answer the question, were these rules invented just to hobble the Biden administration? You know, were these tickets good for one ride only? And now that it's a Trump administration, we go, we just abandon everything we've said in the last 5 years about separation of powers? Or is this a genuine doctrine, a real attempt at a constitutional revolution and a new understanding of separation of powers? And if it's the latter, that is, if the justices want to stick to the principles that they announced in the context of shutting down Biden administration programs, then an enormous amount of what the Trump administration is doing looks blatantly unconstitutional.
So we've talked about the presidential branch and we've talked about the judicial branch, and there's a third branch that hasn't been quite front and center yet. But with midterm elections coming up, we could see a flip in the Congress. Do you think there's an appetite for Congress to try and rein in executive power?
I think that there is. And I should point out, you know, all of these judicial doctrines I'm talking about, none of them have to do with limiting the power of the government in general. They all have to do with saying, no, Congress has to do it. So all of these different rules I'm saying, if the Supreme Court sticks to them, have the consequence not of saying, no, President Trump, you can't do these things at all, but no, you can't do them unless and until you get Congress to authorize those actions, and then the ball is in Congress's court. And the one thing we've seen from this Congress is the last thing in the world they want to do is take responsibility for anything or do anything. This may be the least active Congress in American history. So that's, you're exactly right. This should not be viewed purely as partisan or as a matter of, you know, the Trump administration has angered a judge or something like that. This has been the Roberts Court mission for the last 5 or 6 years, to roll back the administrative state and insist that power vest in Congress and that Congress take responsibility for things like fairly specific rulemaking. Now, there's lots of reasons to find that problematic, but it is intellectually a consistent position. And if Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts in particular, sticks to those guns, right, then this is the absolutely perfect setup to assert the, if you want to say it this way, the duty of Congress to perform its lawmaking function and to refuse to allow the executive to simply adopt all that. I think to answer the political question, there's a lot of appetite to see, you know, whereas Congress has become a real common theme. It's a little hard to know what to make of the Republican members of Congress at their town halls, because we don't actually know if all the people at those town halls had voted for them or were Republicans, right? You know, there's polling data, but it's not horribly clear. But I do get the sense that A, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the Trump administration is going about things. And B, yeah, I think there's a growing sense that part of the problem is here is, where is Congress? And I think both of those things could be very significant in the midterms. I mentioned that with respect to the Supreme Court, I think the Trump administration has overreached. I think in general, they've overreached. I don't think, you know, their very narrow victory gave them the kind of sweeping popular mandate that would allow them to get away with really radical moves. It takes only a small number of Trump voters to say, well, this isn't exactly what I was hoping for, you know, and then they no longer have a majority. And so, frankly, my prediction is that the Republicans will fare badly in the 2026 midterms, as incumbent parties usually do in the first term of a presidency.
Or some number of people who chose not to vote at all because they were disgusted by everybody.
Right. No, I mean, voting is a complicated phenomenon. We keep trying to reduce it to a single thing. It's partly mobilization of voters. It's partly persuasion of voters. It's partly voters who are low information. It's some voters who are very high information, but single issue driven. Right. There isn't. It's not a single phenomenon. And anytime someone tries to explain the election outcome by a single thing, they're simplifying too much. But certainly, several of the forces, several of the motivations that led voters to support Trump in 2024 are less persuasive now than they seemed at the time. Of course, a lot can happen between now and November of 2026, particularly the economy. But if Trump continues, if the Trump administration continues with its current trade and economic policies, it seems likely that, if I may quote James Carville in a recent interval, he said, "I've recently rediscovered that it really is always and forever the economy, stupid."
All right. We've been speaking with Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Howard Schwaber from the University of Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz once again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's 8:26. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock Buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. It's time, as we do each and every week, for the Outdoor Adventure Report with Master Naturalist Paul Noldner. Hey there, Paul. What's happening outside?
Hey there, Brother Ryan. And thank you, WORT, for covering all things natural. Your Outdoor Adventure Report for the week of Monday, April 21 to Sunday, April 27 is brought to you by our Madison Friends of Urban Nature Parks, Environmental Community, and Friends Groups, helping connect Madison and kids with nearby nature with free, fun, family-friendly guided outings every week year-round. Join the fun. Did you hear the Martians have landed? Purple Martians, or more correctly spelled Martins, are returning from Central America, which is about as far from Mars as these little blue swallows can get. They are looking for earthly homes shaped like space capsules that we humans provide for them, as we have done for thousands of years when Native Americans hung gourds in their gardens. Come to the Madison Bird Nature Festival at Warner Park, Sunday, April 27, and at 1 p.m. we will raise a new starship-looking Martin house with 12 white gourd capsules raised by Warner Pond to greet our returning Martians. This past week, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress and DNR took public input on natural resource management, including sandhill cranes. Thank you, everyone who voted. Nature lovers enjoyed wildflower walks, returning warblers, a birdathon, wingspan games, and an Earth Week cleanup. This coming week is jam-packed with Earth Week activities, everybody. Celebrate Earth Week with Eco Songs on Monday. Tonight, join Madison singer-songwriter Ken Longquist at Harmony Bar Monday evening, April 20, 4 to 6 p.m. for fun, imaginative, meaningful songs for all ages. Ken will do eco songs for kids and eco songs for adults. And he will do another performance Sunday, April 27 at our Madison Bird and Nature Festival at Warner Park. Join Nelson Institute on Earth Day for Toxins at the Tap, the future of PFAS in our water supply. Tuesday, April 22, 7 p.m. at the Discovery Building. Learn about PFAS, forever chemicals, the challenges they pose for environmental and public health, water systems, and the policy changes needed to safeguard our future. Experience the seasonal beauty of Wisdom Prairie by registering at holywisdommonastery.org for free guided spring tours through the restored prairies, savannas, and woodlands of Holy Wisdom to share our story of caring for the earth and help deepen our relationship with the land. Join Mount Horeb's Slow Mo May Project on Wednesday, April 23, 6:30 at Mount Horeb Public Library for a special presentation of What's the Rush by entomologist Doug Tallamy, the leader of the homegrown national park movement, making your yard into a park to create habitat and support insects and wildlife and help make our communities environmentally friendly. Join Get Kids Outside for a spring wildflower and bird hike Saturday morning, April 26, 10 a.m. at Elder Leopold Nature Center to look for flowers and birds. A snack will be served with a warm fire. See GetKidsOutsideWI.com under events to register. Wisconsin Ecolatinos invites families in the community to celebrate Earth Day at the Bilingual Environmental Conservation Fair, El Dia de la Tierra, on Saturday, April 26, 11 a.m. to 3 at Elver Park. Enjoy a fun-filled day with educational exhibits, music, free tree saplings, and raffles for water filters and kites. A greener planet starts with us. Families and kids will enjoy Do You Hear a Frog on a free bird nature adventure Saturday morning, April 26, 10 a.m. at Elder Leopold and Edna Taylor with naturalist Doug Davis to look and listen for signs of spring. Do you hear a frog? Do you see a robin? Learn about shifting spring on a free bird nature adventure Saturday afternoon, April 26, 1:30 at Pheasant Branch, meeting by the Prairie Encampment parking lot. Master naturalist Kathleen Wolf will lead a walk to look for and learn about changes in phenology, such as when trees leave out and when birds migrate in a warmer world, and the impacts and what we can do. Enjoy a beautiful free spring wildflower walk, bird and nature adventures, Sunday afternoon, April 27, 1:30 p.m. at UW Lakeshore Nature Preserve with preserve volunteers Glenda Denniston and Eve Emschweller to look for woodland wildflowers at Picnic Point at Bill's Woods, where the friends are helping restore native plants. Join hundreds of nature lovers, families, friends, and kids at the 13th Annual Medicine Bird Nature Festival, Sunday afternoon, April 27, from noon to 4. Come anytime at Warner Park Community Recreation Center on Northport Drive. And you can do the walk-up, ongoing open-door bird sanctuary, live raptor show to see hawks and owls up close. You can help raise a purple martin house, plant an Arbor Day tree, and help to and listen to short readings from Trish O'Kane's new book, Birding to Change the World, about connecting kids with nature. Enjoy food carts, music, indoor and outdoor nature group exhibits, walks, presentations of all kinds. Kids will love the bat cave, aquatics, pond dipping, face painting, kite flying, and lots of other fun activities. You can take a canoe for a short paddle and try kids fishing in the pond. Learn about year-round fun, healthy nature recreation, education, and volunteer opportunities near you, and you'll get to hear Brian and I tooting a few Earth tunes. Find more details and activities at cityofmadison.com parks and tinyurl.com Madison Fun Adventures, and on Facebook and social media with your local environmental community and friends groups. Take a walk this week by a pond with a martin house and watch for returning purple martians. It's naturally fun.
Thank you, Paul. And that brings us to the song of the week. John Wilson, what sounds good to you?
Well, Brian, you probably heard that the Pope died, but I don't know if you remember that it was 9 years ago to the day that Prince left us. Mm. And as luck would have it, back in 1993, Prince released I don't even know if it was a single. It was eventually released on a best of compilation, but it's called Pope. And I feel like that's especially fitting. So here is a 1994 UK promotional remix 12-inch single of Prince's Pope.
A loop is a loop is a loop. A loop is a loop is a loop. A loop is a loop is a loop, yeah. A loop is a loop is a loop, yeah. I say you could be the president, yeah. I'd rather be the Pope, yeah. The Pope. I say you could be the president. I'd rather be the Pope. Kick it.
zebby dippy dippy dope, but the whole damn nation got the same. Money only fly to the B, they're supporting not the president with government lane. Put me on a slow moving parliamentary hacking bandwagon, you can put me little ass in the grave. Every time you want it, I'll be live, bring a date. I mean computer when it's over, press save. So you can be the president. I'd rather be the Pope.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Children's Theater of Madison, presenting The Trials, May 2nd through 11th in the Starlight Theater at the Madison Youth Art Center at 1055 East Mifflin Street. The Trials addresses the climate emergency and intergenerational conflict. The play is intended to spark discussion and debate about climate change, responsibility, and accountability. Recommended for ages 13 and up. Tickets and information at ctmtheater.org.
Clarence Thomas is now the longest tenured member of the U.S. Supreme Court, first appointed to the country's highest court in 1991 by President George Herbert Walker Bush. Thomas's appointment hearings grew bitter and heated over allegations of sexual harassment of Anita Hill when both worked at the U.S. Department of Education. Thomas won appointment in the Senate by a 52-48 margin. Among the senators voting to confirm was Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware. In his 34 years on the bench, Thomas has gained a reputation as the court's most conservative member. He's also recently developed a reputation as corrupt, having received multiple favors from wealthy conservatives with interests before the U.S. Supreme Court. But Brooklyn College professor of political science Corey Robbins says there's more to Thomas than meets the eye, and you underestimate his jurisprudence at your own peril. Robin will speak at the University of Wisconsin's Humanities Without Boundaries lecture on April 24th. Corey Robin joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You talk about a number of cliches about Thomas, but you say that there's aspects of his political philosophy that many liberals would agree with. And explain that, because it's hard for many people to imagine someone who's voted against affirmative action, voted against abortion, been a staunch defender of the Second Amendment rights. It's hard to imagine that there's much in common with current liberal thought.
Well, you have to start by knowing a little bit about Thomas's background and where he comes from and what he used to think before he became a justice on the court. Thomas really begins as a Black nationalist on the left, and he makes a slow migration to the right, but he never loses certain key assumptions of that Black nationalism from his younger days. One of those assumptions is that racism is a permanent fact of American politics and American life and the American economy. It's not going away. White people will always be racist. And I think that's the first thing that Thomas shares with parts of the left, is that racism is an ineradicable fact. The second is that racism will always color everything that the U.S. government does, the American state does. And I think there you also see some very similar beliefs. And the third, and here's where he departs from the left, but I think parts of the left could still nevertheless find this intelligible, is that he thinks that all political efforts to remediate the position of Black people are ultimately somewhat hopeless because they're bounded by these hard facts of white supremacy. So I think that's the deep underlying pessimism about racial progress that I think he has a certain kind of an affinity with parts of the left.
So let's talk about that background. I mean, you mentioned he started as a leftist black nationalist. I think for many people that's kind of hard to fathom. Where did he come from and where did he develop that sensibility?
He's born he comes from the South. He comes from Georgia. But in 1968, he comes north to the College of Holy Cross. And I think that journey north for him was a real shocker. And this is all from his own personal testimony and memoirs and writing. It's all very consistent. Thomas was very familiar with the obvious color line in the South, with white supremacists who didn't put a smile on their faces. And when he comes to the North, he encounters a different side of white racism. The people with smiling faces who tell lies. That's a famous song from the early 70s that was one of his favorite songs, as it turns out. And in that encounter with Northern racism, what we might call liberal racism, the kind of seemingly benevolent, seemingly well-meaning, but nevertheless still believing in black inequality, in his encounter with that, he is drawn towards the writings and speeches of Malcolm X. He had records of all of those speeches. That's how people back then used to hear things that they hadn't heard live. And he memorized those speeches. He could still recite lines from them well into the 1980s, if not beyond. And he took from Malcolm X this idea that when it comes to white people, your biggest enemy, the one you should be most worried about, is not the white wolf with obvious fangs, but the white fox. From Malcolm X, he becomes much, much more of a militant black nationalist, black separatist, saying that you just cannot rely upon white people for much of anything. You have to really look to the black community. So he finds a real inspiration in Malcolm X and helps found the Black Student Union at Holy Cross. He's the secretary treasurer of it. And they really have a very strong Afrocentric, fairly separatist idea of black student politics. And he's very active. This isn't just incidental kind of activism. He's very committed. People remember him that way. He helps lead one of the major events on that campus during that time. He leads a black student walkout where they just simply leave the campus in protest over a racist incident on campus. He really develops this black separatist philosophy, which he will eventually lose the more activist elements and certainly the more progressive and left elements, but will keep certain ideas of the separatism and certain ideas about black male leadership that will still remain very important to him.
One of the things Thomas is renowned for in the court is having little respect for precedent, as shown in the Dobbs decision, where he voted in the majority to throw out many, many, many years of precedent and subsequent court decisions simply on the basis that he felt it didn't meet the Constitution.
And this is something that, in fact, Scalia would gently mock him for, was that Scalia, I can't remember the exact quote, but Scalia, when it came to this question of precedent, Scalia said, "I'm an originalist, but I'm not crazy." You know, he, Thomas, is crazy. He really is willing to kind of go the full nine yards. But yeah, he, this is what he's been known for quite some time, is just going through one precedent after another and tossing them out. What's been interesting, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that when he does these things, people oftentimes dismiss them as crazy, and which he may very well be. But what ends up happening is that those moves to toss out precedents slowly but surely start commanding a majority on the Supreme Court, and ultimately you get decisions that nobody would have anticipated.
You described his racial philosophy as talked about racism always existing. There's not a lot that government can do about that. It sounds almost like a nihilist kind of view. Is he sort of a nihilist?
I can totally see why you would say that. And I understand. I could see that. I don't think so. Ultimately, what pulls him back from nihilism, although it can come awfully close to that, is a term that you see all over his writing, which is about the survival of the black community. Earlier generations of black freedom struggle folks really believed in the transformation of America. They believed in the possibility of emancipation for Black people. Thomas does not believe in progress. He doesn't believe in advance. He doesn't really believe in emancipation. What he is most struck by in Black American history, which I should point out, he is very familiar with. Scholars of African American history have noted this before, and whom he cites in his decisions. He really knows Black American history. But what he takes from Black American history is that this group of people, Black people, survived against institutions that he himself has called totalitarian institutions. Rather than being a nihilist, he's more of a survivalist, which frankly can be equally terrifying in certain situations. And I think it's that survivalism, frankly, that explains some of his positions on the right to bear arms, which he roots in the Reconstruction era, where arming of Black men was considered to be the condition for the survival of Black families and Black communities. And he really takes his cues from these very dark moments of American history where Black people survive, don't thrive, don't flourish, but survive. Often, he believes, because of the strength of Black men, which is the other really important feature of his philosophy. He is not an egalitarian. So when we say he's a Black nationalist or Black separatist, it's not because he believes in equality. He doesn't. He really believes in the superiority of Black men, in particular over Black women. The survival of Black men and the fate of Black people for Thomas is dependent upon the survival and the fate of Black men.
Why is it important to know this about Thomas?
I think there's two reasons, one for legal reasons and one for political reasons. And I'm more interested, to be honest, in the second than the first. I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar. But the legal reason is something we touched on slightly earlier, which is that Thomas is often very much in front of the court. And if you're trying to develop a long-term strategy, if you're trying to think of where things are going, keeping an eye on him is really important. It may not matter in this one particular case at the immediate moment, but if you're trying to figure out where the conservative movement and legal conservatism is headed, he's a very a good person to keep an eye on. The political reason is that we have seen in the last 8 years two developments. One is the rise of this really strong white nationalist philosophy on the right and in the Republican Party. It was always there, but it's been really accentuated. And I think one of the things that's interesting about Thomas is from the very get-go, Donald Trump said that Clarence Thomas was his favorite Supreme Court justice. And it's the ways in which a pessimistic, conservative Black nationalism can fit with a white nationalist philosophy. In recent years, we've begun to see the real political consequences of what I've just said. And that is, you're seeing a slow movement, it's not huge, of Black voters moving to the Republican Party to vote for Trump, and particularly Black male voters. When I have talked about this book in audiences, I can't tell you how often Black people in the audience will come up to me. They will say, "You are describing my father when you were talking about Clarence Thomas." I think Thomas speaks for a certain kind of Black male, often older voter, who is very disaffected with the failure to achieve racial equality and Black emancipation in this country. And he speaks to a kind of souring on the possibilities of racial progressivism. And so I think the reason why we should see Thomas as important is that, in a way, I don't want to say he is the face of the future. I think that's far too strong. But he is the face of a profound disaffection with racial progress and with Black politics altogether. And to that extent, he is, I think, not simply the most powerful Black writing voice in the country, but is speaking to a larger problem that America has had, which is what happens when Black freedom and Black equality no longer seems like a viable political vision for a group of people. And I think that's why he's important.
I just want to touch real quickly on, we mentioned in the introduction, some of the corruption allegations on Thomas. And you have said as well that that's also fairly consistent. Can you talk about that? Does that have to do with his ideas about money and speech?
Yeah. Thomas has, again, always been in the forefront on the question of money and speech. He believes profoundly that particularly in a capitalist society, which she's a big believer in, that how we spend our money is an expression of what we believe and what we value and what we think. And this can get into some very technical, wonky stuff about the First Amendment and campaign finance and so forth. But he has developed a whole philosophy around that issue. So much so that when a lot of the corruption scandals broke recently, and I say broke somewhat in quotes because these stories have long been known. They were reported in the Los Angeles Times back in the aughts, but the scale of it was really not known until recently. But when I read those stories, you know, they are very consistent with his philosophy that in a capitalist democracy, where money is speech, the wealthiest people are going to have the most access, the most impact. Their speech is going to be the weightiest, not because it's the smartest, not because it's the most correct, but because it has the most money behind it. And so you can, you know, accuse him of many things in those corruption scandals, and I think corruption is the right word. But hypocrisy, I don't think, will cut it. I think it's very consistent with the kinds of things he has said over the years.
All right. We've been speaking with Corey Robin, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Robin will give a presentation entitled Clarence Thomas's Radical Race Politics and the Future of the Supreme Court at the University of Wisconsin Center for the Humanities on Thursday, April 24th at 5 p.m. in the Elvium Building, 800 University Avenue. Corey Robin, thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Thank you, and hope to see everybody on Thursday at the talk.
It's 8:51. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock Buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Founded in 2014, World Beyond War has sought not only the global abolition of warfare, but the development of alternative peaceful means to resolve international and internal conflict. In the last 11 years, the nonprofit has grown to dozens of chapters and hundreds of affiliates worldwide. Here in Madison, two on-campus chapters will sponsor events to highlight anti-war actions in the U.S. and elsewhere. First up, on April 21st, the Wolfpack chapter of World Beyond War will host a discussion at Madison College with Representative Mark Pocan about the Congressional Reduced Defense Spending Caucus. Next, on April 23rd, the University of Wisconsin chapter will host a screening of the documentary The Palestine Exception, which looks at the 2024 disinvestment campaigns across university campuses in the United States. Janet Parker is the coordinator for the Madison chapter of World Beyond War, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Thank you, Brian. I love your show, and what a privilege to be on it. And I'm actually co-coordinator of the Madison chapter.
Well, thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about how World Beyond War fits in with, there's a lot of anti-war organizations out there. How does World Beyond War fit in with that, and what makes it different?
Yeah. Thank you. Well, we're war abolitionists. So we think that all war is wrong. We think that government should never be engaging in organized mass murder, which is really what war is. So it's not complicated. Do we support this war or that one? What about in Ukraine? No, government should never be killing people and sending others to go out and be shot at and killed and probably do things they're going to regret the rest of their lives. We're against all wars.
So some classic examples of so-called good wars, the Civil War from the Union side to end slavery, World War II to try and eliminate fascism in Europe.
Yes.
Under those circumstances, please? Also not justified war?
Exactly. It's always better to negotiate and find a solution. It never improves the state of humanity to go out and kill lots and lots of people. Look at our website for arguments specifically about the Civil War and about World War II, because the history that we learn about that is very flawed. And we also, you know, in general, we learn a history that's about jumping from one war to the next and ignoring the enormous amount of what our friend on UW campus, Nam Kim, anthropologist, calls peace fair, the history of all that societies do to prevent war. We need to know that history, and we're working at World Beyond War to try to abolish war. We're asking for the whole thing. 200 years ago, slavery abolitionists were told, oh, that will never happen. And we're not there. Slavery is not gone, but there's no government in the world that now thinks that slavery is acceptable. So these changes can happen. We can make change. But anyway, I'm here to talk about today's event.
Indeed, right. Yes. So you've got an event coming today, and Mark Bocan is the founder of the Congressional Reduced Defense Spending Caucus, which sounds great and sounds like it's exactly the kind of thing that World Beyond War would do. Is founding a caucus enough? Is that enough? Is that all we ask of our legislators?
Yeah, thanks. Mark Bocan is fantastic. The students are delighted that he's going to join us today, and we invite all your listeners, please come and ask him questions. From 2:30 to 3:15, Mark is going to be there on campus.
This is the Truax campus of Madison
Truax
College.
Truax campus, right. So it's on the Wright Street, 1701 Wright Street. The room is D1630. We're so glad that Representative Bocan will be there. The students will be talking with him and asking him questions. As you say, he has done a lot. He founded and co-chairs the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus. I was looking up yesterday the exact wording of what that caucus is called, and I saw just how many caucuses there are. One of the caucuses that I had to laugh about is called the Corrosion Prevention Caucus. This is a caucus in our Congress. So caucuses are great. We're really glad that Mark Bocan is part of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus. We're glad that he always votes against defense allocations bills. He wants to audit the Pentagon, and he's introduced legislation about that. And we'll be asking him, what more can he do? Could he, like Chris Van Hollen has just last week become very much of an international figure interrogating the Trump administration on immigration? Could Mark Bocan be doing that nationally and on the international stage? Mark has gone to visited Palestine in the past. Could he visit Israel-Palestine now and speak against genocide? He's brave in confronting AIPAC. Could he do more? And what more? What specifically can he do? Students will be asking this. They're also going to be having conversation between the 9 different MITC clubs that are co-sponsoring this event. So it'll be cool. Come see the students and support these war abolitionist students.
And then on April 23rd, at the University of Wisconsin chapter, you've got the screening of the documentary, The Palestine Exception. Tell us about that.
Yeah, students on UW-Madison campus are totally on the move, too. And as we know, the divestment anti-genocide movement across the country last year is just amazing. And there's a brand new documentary that the students will be screening on Wednesday night, 6:00 at the Memorial Union. It's in a basement room that's called the Chart Room at the Memorial Union. It's a film and discussion. And the incomparable Professor Samer Alitu is going to be speaking in part of the discussion. Also, 2 key student movement leaders, Dalia Saba and Abby Klein. So it'll be a chance to see this vital new documentary about the student movement and free speech on campuses and repression on campuses, but also the students are going to pause the film several times for discussion. So there'll be a lot of chance to talk in small groups and hear from these amazing panelists.
All right.
So that's Wednesday.
We've been speaking with Janet Parker, coordinator for the Madison chapter of World Beyond War. The Solidarity for Peace event featuring Congressman Mark Bocan takes place today, Monday, April 21st from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Truax campus of Madison College, and the screening of The Palestine Exception takes place on April 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the UW Memorial Union. Janet Parker, thank you for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Thank you, Brian Standing.
And that wraps up our program for today. I'd like to thank our guests, political scientist Howard Schwaber, Brooklyn College professor Corey Robin, and Janet Parker from World Beyond War. Thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, who lined up the great guests you heard here today and kept everything running smoothly down at the studio. Thanks also to our engineer, John Wilson, who piloted the mighty WORT soundboard and spun all the great tunes. Thanks also to our receptionist, Chuck Benesch. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We're also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming your way right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 21st.
This is Bird Note. Great-tailed grackles live up to their name. The glossy black males trail their long, V-shaped tails behind them as they fly, almost like a plane towing a banner ad. And while not quite as flashy, the brown-feathered females have impressively long tails, too. The males settle disputes by fanning their tails. But if the feathers aren't enough to intimidate their rival, a wrestling match ensues. Also known as the Mexican grackle, this species lives in all sorts of habitats, from the northern coasts of South America to the western U.S. They keep their nests secure in tall trees, sometimes over 60 feet high. Their ability to live in both cities and farmland has helped great-tailed grackles expand as far north as Iowa. But they're still more abundant in Central America and southern Texas, where their cacophony of calls helps create the local soundscape. Great-tailed grackles rattle, screech, whistle, and creak, sounding more machine than bird at times.